Welcome to Cardiovascular Matters. Whether you are looking for answers for yourself or someone you love, we are here to give you the best information available. Each week, the founder of Cardiovascular Institute of the South, Dr. Craig Walker, and medical device sales veteran, Terry Roberts, discuss the causes, symptoms, treatment, and prevention of health-related issues stemming from cardiovascular disease. Now here's your hosts, Dr. Craig Walker and Terry Roberts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Cardiovascular Matters. This week, we're going to be furthering a discussion about varicose veins to include obstructive venous disorders. I've got Dr. Craig Walker here, and he's going to be picking up where we left off last week. Thank you, Dr. Walker. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. So one of the classifications of disease that really was poorly understood for many years and is still, in my opinion, poorly understood and appreciated are obstructive venous disorders. Now, obstructive venous disorders are when it is not necessarily a clot that is obstructing blood flow, but something which either compresses a vein or shuts or scores a vein down. And so some of the earlier disorders like this were Scalenius Anticus syndrome and first rib syndromes, where the first rib would cause compression on the subclavian vein or the axillary vein, causing it to ultimately clot or score down. And one would then have to remove clot and remove the rib to get rid of that obstruction. But there have been many, many more of these which have come about. We know that certainly cancer can cause big lymph nodes, or certain infections can cause lymph nodes. Lymph nodes can, by simply growing next to a vein, can compress the veins. But perhaps the most important, and I think the most often undiagnosed disorder, is iliac vein compression. Now, iliac vein compression was first really described in large measure by two doctors named May and Thurner. And often people call it May-Thurner syndrome because of that. The other name that many people call it is Crockett's syndrome. But in this case, our big artery coming down from the heart, the aorta, in order to go to each leg, has to divide. It divides into two arteries called iliac arteries. Now, the aorta is on the left side of the vein, which blood brings blood back, the inferior vena cava. Now, as the right common iliac artery divides off of the aorta, it must first cross the left common iliac vein, and then it must cross the right common iliac vein. And it can compress that vein against the backbone, against the fourth lumbar vertebrae. Now, the artery is high pressure, the vein is low pressure, and the backbone is rigid. So what happens is that arterial pressure squeezes down that vein, and it's very difficult for blood to get through this vein. And often that may predispose one to developing clot. In fact, whenever we see someone come in and they've, in particular, left-sided clot in a leg, and the leg becomes very swollen, much more so than the other, we shouldn't just say, hey, you've got a clot. We should say, well, do you have maybe underlying May-Thurner syndrome? Why? Well, because these people are far more apt, if untreated, to have more clots, but they're also more apt to develop venous ulceration in the future. And in fact, if we look at patients presenting with extensive venous ulcers, or those who have very advanced seep changes, those who I've mentioned before have discoloration of the lower leg or that champagne glass finding, there's a high probability of them having underlying iliac vein compression. Now, this is not as uncommon as we once thought. In fact, we know that if we look at autopsies of people age 70 or over, there's evidence of some degree of iliac vein compression in a huge percentage of those. Some would say as many as 70%. Now, most of the time, that's subclinical. Nothing needs to be done with that. Nonetheless, it is important if one has had problems and has developed advanced seep classifications where we're having extensive scoring of the leg, or we're having problems such as venous ulcers, then being able to treat that is important. And the treatment for this is simply ballooning it and putting a stent. And the stent serves to hold the vessel open, and it stops the artery from compressing it against the backbone. It's a very elegant treatment, and often I've seen patients who may have had a venous ulcer for 30 years without healing, heal within a matter of 1 or 2 months. And that's what iliac vein compression can mean, because the iliac vein is the master drain for that whole leg. And as you might imagine, it's going to affect venous flow a lot more than any superficial vein could ever affect venous flow. Now, it's not the easiest thing to diagnose, however. Okay, you have to first understand that that can occur, and you have to look for it. So you look for it by first you perform an ultrasound, and sometimes in thin people, we can actually directly see the iliac veins pretty well. But often you can't see them very well at all, particularly in some of our patients who might weigh 250 or 300 pounds. Obviously, it's a deeper route for the ultrasound to see because it's way back near the backbone, and it may be difficult to tell. So there has to be a high index of suspicion. Now, what we can see when we cannot see the iliac veins perfectly is we can see the femoral veins. Those are right at the groin crease. And if we see femoral veins and there's loss of phasic flow and there's some insufficiency noted, blood is flowing in the wrong direction at the femoral veins, then that increases the possibility of there being iliac vein compression or May-Thurner syndrome. So if that's the case, then the diagnostic test of choice is to do a venogram coupled with intravascular ultrasound. Now, the intravascular ultrasound that we use to make these images, we place over a soft guide wire. So we're in the deep vein system, and as we advance this intravascular ultrasound, at the tip, it gives us an image that's round. And what we're seeing is a round image that's fairly big. And if there's compression, when we get to the site of compression, we can see that the vessel is actually squashed at that point. And if it is, we then balloon this and we place a stent at that site. This is very important. I've seen some people say, well, why not just balloon it? Well, if you just balloon it, it's going to get squished again. Right. Just that simple. It doesn't work with that. Now, some of the symptoms of May-Thurner syndrome that's subclinical, I've mentioned clot can occur. It's one of the causes of people who have really big pulmonary emboli, which is also a vein disorder. And in fact, and we'll speak of that in a different session, but that's a number two cause of sudden death. And it's a number one cause of hospital-acquired deaths that's preventable. So certainly also very important, but May-Thurner syndrome can play a role in causation, in causing clot to form. Now, this becomes very important. An index of suspicion is there. So what are some of the symptoms? Well, if one notes chronic leg swelling, particularly if one side is worse than the other. But to be fair, both sides can be compressed with May-Thurner syndrome. So you may have it on both sides. But if you see one leg with tremendous swelling and not the other, particularly if it's the left leg, that typically is indicative of May-Thurner syndrome. That's why when we look at big clots, iliac clots, 2/3 of them are in the left leg, not the right. And that's a function of May-Thurner syndrome. Otherwise, it should be 50-50. The clot should be exactly equal. So this is a diagnosis, I think, that's crucially important to make, often not made. And I can tell you, when a patient sees this and has it treated, it's amazing to see how they feel. I have one lady whose husband had venous ulcers for 30 years, and she was changing bed sheets 3 times a night because he was oozing so much fluid. And within a few months, this venous ulcer was healed. Now, he had seen many, many people in the process of 30 years. Now, the same lady, she lives about 60 miles away. Every month, she brings all of my office staff food. And she brings it, and I tell her, that's way too much work. And she says, Doc, it's nowhere near as much work as changing bed sheets three times a night, Amen. Every night. And I tell that story because I think it's a problem that people suffer through that is trivialized in our society. We go, you got to do this, you got to do that. This deserves aggressive workup and aggressive treatment because this treatment is not a very risky procedure at all. It's very low risk. It can be very efficacious, and it can absolutely be transformative to someone's life. And it's interesting. When one treats a patient like this, who's had a vein ulcer forever, they find patients elsewhere around their towns, and they send them. It's very interesting how many patients this one lady has sent me from her little town. She's from a little town. She sent me more than a dozen patients that she diagnosed as probably having Mayth-Erner syndrome, which I think is interesting. And I think it's one of the things that I've always believed in my medical practice. I really believe that what you have to do is communicate with patients. You have to educate patients and tell them, this is what we're seeing and this is why. Now, sometimes Mayth-Erner syndrome is not as easy to diagnose. Sometimes it's right on the borderline of, is it a significant obstruction or not? And sometimes we may want to watch those a little bit. So this is not always black and white. Now, I've heard many people say, well, we can always make that diagnosis by using a CT angiogram. Well, several studies have suggested that's not true, that intravascular ultrasound is the gold standard in what you have to use. Also, many have said, well, you can use an MRA. Well, again, it's a good study. It's very expensive, but it is not the gold standard. The gold standard is to look at the vein with intravascular ultrasound. And you can say, why doesn't the phenogram show it? Because you're certainly injecting dye and you're looking. We use that when we work with the heart. Well, the reason is, when you're looking at the iliac veins right as they divide, if the blockage is from the front to the back, okay, and you're looking just from the front, you won't see that. You won't see where it's squished. And if you try to come from the side to look at it to get a better idea of how much is squished, you're looking at both veins, and so you can't see through and through it. So that is why the gold standard is not venography. If venography shows a totally blocked vein, or if it shows what we call transpelvic collaterals, that means blood is going from one vein, one iliac vein on one side to the other, 100% of those people are going to have iliac vein compression. Now, what else does iliac vein compression do? It can be a source of infertility because it affects the venous flow out of the uterus. Okay, it can be a problem. What else? Well, it can cause dysmenorrhea. It can cause dyspareunia or painful sex. It can have other life-threatening abnormalities in both women and in men. But all so often, it is not recognized. I mentioned in men, often it is associated with varicoceles that may be found in the testes of men. But this compressed vein results in a higher pressure in that vein that is sustained in that vein. That also causes further down the leg more chances of developing vein insufficiency. So these things all work together. But when you're talking about the main drain of the leg, I liken this to a house. In a house, one has lavatories. You've got sink drains. You've got toilet drains. You've got all of these. But they all ultimately dump into one master drain. And if that master drain doesn't work, none of the other drains are going to work well. The iliac vein and the inferior vena cava are the master drains of the leg. And they have to work properly or else a patient will continue to have problems.
That is very interesting. One of the things that came to mind when you talk about compressed venous situation going on, and there's clot on board. Is there anything you do with the clot? Do you try to remove that, or when you're stenting, or how does that work?
Yes. If there is clot, we do try to remove it. You know, in the old days, that meant giving clot busters, or what we call thrombolytic agents. And they're effective, and they can clearly remove clot, but they're slow, and they can result in bleeds. And sometimes those bleeds can be life-threatening or can kill people if you bleed into the brain or other areas. So what has moved? We're trying to, if we have clot, we either try to move to use less of the clot dissolvers or now with some of the new tools to just simply mechanically remove the clot. And we have a whole host of devices. We have devices which suck out the clot. They use negative suction techniques. We have some that actually go and grab the clot. We can pull the clot out. And I'll show cases of that when we speak about pulmonary emboli, when people are coming in and can't breathe because a blood clot has moved to the lungs. But with these devices, we can instantly remove clot. And what's so amazing, and for instance, in a patient who's thrown this blood clot to the lung, this patient may come in on oxygen and unable to catch their breath. They still are very short of breath. And in minutes, in a couple minutes, we remove a big clot, and that patient on no oxygen is perfectly comfortable. These have been, in my opinion, game-changing totally. So if we had an iliac vein that had clot, it had not moved to the lungs. It had not been displaced. Then what we would try to do is remove that clot first and then stent the vessel. That would be the treatment protocol. It is better, though, if we can get to an iliac vein compression before clot occurs, because if we look at the likelihood of a stent staying open, it is much better if you are not post-thrombotic or post-clot. So much better to pick it up earlier, when the first symptoms are legs swelling. Believe it or not, Terry, one of the things that people feel with obstructed veins is shortness of breath and decreased exercise capacity. And the reason for that is there was a large study that came out of Yale looking at that with Swan-Ganz catheters. The reason for the shortness of breath is you're not returning blood to the heart properly. So you're not on a good part of the heart mechanism we call the Frank-Stork mechanism, which allows you to pump blood more efficiently. Some people notice they get weak when they stand up. Again, venous return to the heart is not what it needs to be, you know, to sustain the blood pressure like it should. So this is a real problem. And, you know, the problem of venous obstruction goes beyond this. We know that dialysis patients who need dialysis, there needs to be an access to get to the veins if they're on hemodialysis. Today, we've improved dialysis, and patients are living much longer on dialysis. And now what's happening with hemodialysis, often there are patients with many years left to live who no longer have a graft that is still functioning. And so we have to open up those veins. We open those, that's an obstructive disease as well. When we take high-pressure artery flow and put it into a vein to cause a fistula, that vein often scars down at that site. Even though a vein in nature is typically much thinner walled than an artery, a venous stricture is sometimes the hardest area to dilate with a balloon, much harder than arterial blockages. So vein disease is a whole different pathology than artery pathology. Artery pathology is usually, the garden variety is a buildup of plaque, which is blood fats and scar tissue and things such as that. Vein is a scar. Vein is a dense scar when we're dealing with venous disease or a compression. And so, again, we treat it differently. The stents we use for treating vein disease have to be much bigger because veins are much bigger than arteries. Ideally, we want them to have what we call open cells or big interstices that blood can flow through very easily. And we want them to be able to be precisely placed to make sure they won't go anywhere and that they will continue to hold the vessel open. Luckily, we now have very effective stents for treating venous disorders that are allowing us to do a much better job.
Are you able to size those vessels with ultrasound outside the body, or do you use intravenous ultrasound to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, in some cases, one can perfectly size a vessel from the outside of the body, but those are typically deep veins in the leg. Okay, now as we get up into the iliac veins, it's hard to see them as well, mm-hmm. as I've mentioned before. And there, I think, or the vena cava as well, there, I think, it's better to have intravascular ultrasound. And clearly, intravascular ultrasound gives us the clearest picture of how obstructed a vessel is. You must see that. And I don't want to suggest, as I've mentioned before, with Mayth-Erner syndrome, that it only affects the left leg. That is not the case. In roughly a third of cases, it affects the right leg as well. And in fact, there are variants of this that have since been tacked on, where the internal iliac artery, as it takes off, can compress the internal iliac vein a little bit lower, the external iliac vein slightly below that area. So this is a work in progress, if you would, of our understanding. But clearly, iliac vein compression is common. It can increase one's likelihood of developing big clot. And thirdly, it is in many cases the cause of extensive venous ulcers that haven't healed with usual therapies. And being able to address this can be game-changing for these patients. In my practice, I treat coronary blockages or heart blockages, and patients having heart attacks. I treat advanced peripheral vascular disease and patients who were told they're going to get their leg cut off. I treat venous disorders. And I must say that this is one of the things that patients are most appreciative of. And I think in large measure, it's because they feel their diagnosis had been missed and that their cries for help were ignored. And once one fixes this, these are patients for life. These are people that go out, and they not only are patients for life, they mm-hmm. become advocates for life about this disease process. And that's what we need, because we certainly can do a better job. Again, imagine what I've mentioned earlier. Vein disease is the most common cardiovascular disorder, and it may well be the most common pathology in all of medicine, affecting perhaps 50 million plus Americans. It's huge. And we need to pay proper attention to vein disease.
That is another great summation of venous disorders. I want to remind the group listening, if you want to get in touch with Dr. Walker, it's easy. It's www.cardio.com. If you've experienced some of these problems that we've discussed today, and I'm sure his staff will be happy to set you into some type of appointment and get you seen by Dr. Walker. Please come back next week when we'll continue our discussions, and I just welcome everybody to Cardiovascular Matters. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Walker.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks for listening, and please subscribe, like, and share this podcast with your friends and family. Join us next week for new topics and answers with Dr. Craig Walker and Terry Roberts on Cardiovascular Matters.